note, sing out with gusto, and just overwhelm all the crowd. Johnny, one note out loud. Sing, Johnny, one note. Sing, Johnny, one note out loud.
Wow. Okay. David Beispiel, say something. Oh, a little louder, David. Let's see. Yeah, we got you here. Well, we got picking you up. And David Hedges?
Hello, hello.
Okay, okay, okay. We're doing fine. Welcome to the Talking Earth. And guys, we have an important historical mission to correct 50 years of American poetry. Do we or don't we, anyway? David Beispiel has a monthly poetry column in the Sunday Oregonian, now called The Big O, with an exclamation point, and I'm not sure what that means, but David Hedges is, you're no longer the president of the Oregon State Poetry Association, but you're a poet, and you've been dealing with a lot of poets, so guys, why don't you say something about yourself? David Hedges, why don't you begin?
Well, you know, I'm thinking about this theme of what's wrong with poetry, and what I'd like to do when we talk about that is to get into what is right about poetry in Oregon, and I can draw a lot of specific examples of things that are going famously here that are not really necessarily in other parts of the country. And I base a lot of that on the fact that I get correspondence. I get letters from poets in other parts of the country who say, what's going on in Oregon? And you have some of the best poetry coming out anywhere in the state of Oregon. And so this tells me that we are doing something right here. And I have a lot of thoughts on that, but we'll get into that later. I wanted to kind of introduce myself to David by bringing
up David Beispiel.
David,
okay.
Beispiel, yeah. You know, well,
you
Davids.
Guys have worked together.
Yeah, don't just say David. You got to say which one of us. Is
no,
your...
no, I know. David B and David H.
Okay, good,
no, okay.
Good.
Okay.
But in one of your columns, David, you said you grew up with a little treasury of great poetry, and in my life, I had the Winged Horse Anthology and the Oxford Book of American Poetry. And these were books that my father had, and you know, by the way, the Musée des Beaux-Arts is one of my all-time favorites because it makes me say, why am I in this business? You know, and then at the same time, I want to be better. I aspire. It's one of those poems that does that for me. But another thing you wrote was, how many hours a young poet could stare at those portraits and dream of being among them, I don't wish to say. And you did that with A Little Treasury, and I did that with Louis Uttermeyer's Lives of the Poets, and fancied my own biography in there. How old were you when this was going on, when you were aspiring to such heights?
Well, that book was in my house. It was my mother's book. But I wasn't that. I read it, and I was really interested in reading poetry, but I didn't start writing it till I was in my early 20s. So I had, I just felt I needed to have a book like that under my belt a little more than before I started writing. I began writing kind of relatively late compared to, I think, a lot of other people.
I can tell you my own experience. I was closing in on 40, and I had written in high school, and I made my living as a writer, but I was always writing fiction or thinking fiction, and so I got back to poetry rather late. But where did your interest spring from? Was it the reading of that book?
Well, it was that book. It was, you'd go into class at school, and they'd pass out an English textbook understanding your English language and literature, that sort of thing. And I'd immediately go and read the poems. I was just attracted to them.
Yeah.
And when I began to think about that I might want to write, or at least begin having aspirations, I was very hesitant. I didn't want to start writing until I felt I had read more.
Yeah, yeah.
Guys, just for a second here. David, would you talk about yourself? You're from Texas. You've been here 10 years. You're involved with an addict workshop. David, Hedges, just let him, you know.
Right.
We don't know enough about him. We'll get into the theme of this. And I wanted to bring up a couple of points, several of which were, why are we worried about American voter? But let's let David Byspiel just say a few things about yourself. So you're writing a monthly column. It's the first week of the month in the Sunday Oregonian Books and Art, now called the Big O exclamation point.
Yeah, I moved here to Oregon 10 years ago. I'm from Texas. I grew up in the South, but I've lived in a lot of places. I lived in Massachusetts and Vermont and Washington D.C. and San Francisco and many other places. Before I arrived here, I do write this column. It runs once a month, the first Sunday of the month, in which I introduce a poem and talk about something peculiar about poetry that happens to be on my mind or that the poem suggests. About half the poems are from brand new books and about half are whatever's on my...
Well, I think David Hedges and myself want to give you a great big compliment because... those are very articulate discussions, and thank God somebody in the Sunday Oregonian, you know, is really discussing poetry in depth. I saw the last one with, if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Amy Clampett, those are 500-word articles or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah, thank you very much.
Well, congratulations that somebody's doing this, too.
You know. I think the Oregonian's book section coverage of poetry is... hard to rival in the United States in terms of newspapers. They run a poem every couple of weeks. They do a column every couple of weeks. That's 4 weeks out of the month. The only other newspaper I know of that has that much coverage is the Washington Post, and the Toronto Globe and Mail has a column on poetry, or they used to.
I believe in the last Sunday Oregonian, they were saying they were even going to expand. We'll get another week of somebody doing it. But I had mistakenly called you the poetry editor, but I think you have... You know, you have some power to judge, you know. I mean, I think you, for the poem for your column, you choose, I believe, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I can pick the poem.
Well, very good. It's not about the rhyme. Is the poem good? Is it true? That was one of your columns. And maybe that's where we should go. Okay. So, but David Hedges, you guys know each other. So I'm going to let you guys run with the ball a little bit. But I want you to read some poems that are good examples or whatever. But... if I may call you Byspiel, you have an addict workshop. What is this? I have your book, Pilgrims and Beggars, in front of me. And who is the Portlandia Group?
The Portlandia Group is a publishing house, terrific publishing house here in town. That's the publisher. Her name is Karen Browker, a terrific poet. And she runs, I think she publishes one or two books a year of... chapbooks, all the poems that were in Pilgrims and Beggars were in my book-length collection called Wild Civility, which came out a couple of years ago. So it was the New Haven tryout for the later book.
That's what happens. You try it. I believe all poets do that. You bring out a little zine, if we may use that term, and then, you know, you figure out which poems didn't work and which poems. So, guys, let's go back to this. So some of my quick thoughts were something like this. Where are they? Well, they're not quick thoughts, but they're going to be that quick. One of them was that objections. I object to poetry which is too regular in its prosody. Do you say prosody or prosody or rhythm? It's like a metronome. It lulls me to sleep. I want surprise in poetry. I think poets only become poets because they develop their own original voice, their style, which they sort of own, like artists, you know, like Salvador Dali has his style, you know, Robert Frost, God forbid, has his style, and so on and so forth. So One of my big complaints has been here, just to get us started in this discussion, masters of fine arts degrees in poetry are wonderful for teachers to teach the appreciation of poetry and literature, but I don't think that should be an imprimatur, if I may use that kind of word, for to make somebody a poet. And I think that really originality is an authenticity of what's expressed is very important. So also I got very angry with the National Endowment for the Arts because they started publishing poets who were middle of the road. They didn't offend. And I hate, I also hate too much political correctness in poetry. Okay, that's a start for me. So so where are we going to go, guys? This is the theme. What's gone wrong with American poetry in the last 50 years or 30 years? And, well, Hedges, we'll come back to you. Okay.
Well, you know, I wanted to get into the area of education. And, you know, in high school, poetry is crammed down your throat if you if you're exposed to it at all. And in college, you can study poetry, and I believe you majored, didn't you, in writing?
In college, I was an English major.
English major, okay, and then MFA followed that. Did you feel that that prepared you to be a poet, or was, well, I guess Walt's contention here is that poets are born, not made, and you know, I've read all sorts of things about the MFAs and the you know, as being a kind of mill that is, you know, spitting out poets rapid fire, and that somehow there is this great benefit to them, and I've, you know, it's everything from political to, you know, I mean, whether they get published or not. Do you believe that there is some mystique at work here? Or
well, David Weisbiel, jump ahead. Yeah, you're a little less you're more reticent than he and I are. So, jump in here.
Well, I think that a lot of people have made a lot of hay out of attacking the MFA programs. And
yeah.
I think it's an easy target. And a not very worthwhile target. I'm thinking of what Walt was saying about, you know, the education. What he's saying about teaching. We love to have teachers, writers go into schools, when into elementary schools, into middle schools, into high schools, and say people need to write more. We want you to write more. We want you to be more imaginative. We want you to write poetry. We want that to happen in college. But then when someone goes to get a graduate degree, which is only a graduate degree, it's not an imprimatur to anything. It's 2 years of some time to be in a culture in which people are taking you seriously as a poet, and in a culture in which that is rare to non-existent, I don't see any reason to take exception to it.
Mm.
But and then everyone complains that there's too many students in these MFA programs, when throughout their entire educational life they've been being told writing is good, creative writing is good, poetry is good, we should write more, we should all write more, and then they're told that they're worthless. And some of the writing they do is worthless. But some of the writing any poetry of any period does is uninteresting.
Well, let's correct here. Yeah, I don't want to knock. I'm glad, you know, for example, in the city of Portland, there are poets going into the high schools and the junior highs, and they're encouraging kids. I'm not trying to really knock that. It's just when I grew up, you know, and that was a long time ago, in the 50s and early 60s, there were a handful of people who were poets. I mean, Dylan Thomas, and we remember names like Carl Sandburg, Robert Frost. I mean, in other words, to become a poet, even William Stafford, you know, and he earned that in a certain way before.
Stafford went to Iowa.
Yes, he did. Well, there was a writer, thank you, there was a writer's workshop there, and yes.
And he felt lucky to be there.
Okay. Yeah. Each of you pick a poem.
No, listen, I...
but we need some read some poems.
The intervention of fate, I probably would have gone that course myself. But I got this Navy scholarship and went to the wrong college. It happens to be a college you're teaching right now. But the reason it was wrong at the time for me was they had no writing courses. It was all business and technology. And
hasn't changed much. The I think too about the MFA is that it doesn't guarantee you anything.
Yeah.
But every other art asks its students to study. You know, Van Gogh took drawing classes. Painters take painting classes.
In the Renaissance,
and drawing classes.
Michelangelo.
There's not a musician in the world that doesn't have a teacher.
Right.
You know, an opera singer, you know, trained an opera singer. They have a voice coach. It's a natural need for a person to want to get taught by someone who they admire. Does that make them a poet? Of course not.
No. You know, it's, my grandfather was an attorney, and he read for the law. He didn't go to law school, and I didn't study poetry, but I read. And, you know, I think that, and along the way, I had mentors. And this is the most important thing. It's something that I'm trying to give back right now to other people coming up, and I think that's one of the most important things you can do. You give back what you've gained. Are you going to read a poem?
I think let's read a poem or two. We'll come back to the conversation. Thank you, guys. David Beispiel and David.
I thought I would begin with one by, since the MFA came up, I hadn't thought of it this way, but by a poet who was taught in a very famous workshop in the 50s in Boston. Three of his students were in the same room, were W.D. Snodgrass, Anne Sexton, and Sylvia Plath. And this is a poem by Robert Lowell. It's called For the Union Dead. I don't think few people can write like Lowell. And in terms of the question of what's, you know, right or wrong with American poetry, the poem I'm going to read for the Union Dead, I think, for what it's worth, is one of the finest poems written in the last 50 years. It does a lot of things I like. It's smart. It has a beautiful sound to it. And it penetrates its subject beyond what you would expect. For the Union Dead. Have you ever heard Lowell read? You know, he was from the Massachusetts Lowells. The family went back to the Mayflower, practically. But he had this affected Texas accent.
Okay. The Texans are winning out here tonight.
I'm sorry, not Texas accent. It was more of a Robert Penn Warren-ish Kentucky accent.
Yeah, Kentucky accent. Okay.
The Old South Boston Aquarium stands in a Sahara of snow now. Its broken windows are boarded. The bronze weather vane cod has lost half its scales. The airy tanks are dry. Once my nose crawled like a snail on the glass. My hand tingled to burst the bubbles drifting from the noses of the cowled, compliant fish. My hand draws back. I often sigh still for the dark, downward, and vegetating kingdom of the fish and reptile. One morning last March, I pressed against the new barbed and galvanized fence on the Boston Common. Behind their cage, yellow dinosaur steam shovels were grunting as they cropped up tons of mush and grass to gouge their underworld garage. Parking spaces luxuriate like civic sand piles in the heart of Boston. A girdle of orange, Puritan pumpkin-colored girders braces the tingling statehouse, shaking over the excavations as it faces Colonel Shaw and his bell-cheeked Negro infantry on St. Gaudens' shaking Civil War relief, propped by a plank splint against the garage's earthquake. 2 months after marching through Boston, half the regiment was dead. At the dedication, William James could almost hear the bronze Negroes breathe. Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. Its colonel is as lean as a compass needle. He has an angry, wren-like vigilance, a greyhound's gently tautness. He seems to wince at pleasure and suffocate for privacy. He is out of bounds now. He rejoices in man's lovely, peculiar power to choose life and die. When he leads his black soldiers to death, he cannot bend his back. On 1,000 small town New England greens, the old white churches hold their air of sparse, sincere rebellion. Frayed flags quilt the graveyards of the Grand Army of the Republic. The stone statues of the abstract Union soldier grow slimmer and younger each year. Wasp wasted. they doze over muskets and muse through their sideburns. Shaw's father wanted no monument except the ditch where his son's body was thrown and lost with his niggers. The ditch is near. There are no statues for the last war here. On Boylston Street, a commercial photograph shows Hiroshima boiling over a Mosler safe, the rock of ages that survived the blast. Space is near. When I crouch to my television set, the drained faces of Negro school children rise like balloons. Colonel Shaw is riding on his bubble. He waits for the blessed break. The aquarium is gone. Everywhere giant finned cars nose forward like fish. A savage servility slides by on Greece.
Okay. Ooh. Long poem.
Yeah.
It's a good poem, and Robert Lowell, in his latter years, was a great anti-Vietnam War spokesperson with Norman Mailer and others, and it's an interesting poem. Where would you keep the poetry going, David? We're at 23 minutes, 25 minutes after, so you've got to keep moving along.
Right.
I promise not talking heads tonight.
I told David earlier that I had brought an anti-war poem, but it wasn't overtly political. It's one of my more recent ones that I'm writing about my childhood, and it's I think there's a book coming. I feel it. Skipping Sunday school. I learned more about God in the front seat of my family's 34 Plymouth four-door sedan than I ever did in Sunday school, which I skipped religiously while the folks absorbed their sermon, sang their hymns, recited the Lord's Prayer and benediction, and dropped their little white envelope in the deep dish, making its way from pew to pew in the stone and stained glass splendor of Westminster Presbyterian Church. Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms were my teachers. Mozart and Vivaldi, as the Firestone Hour wrapped me in the flowing robes of fiery gods, oblivious to sunlight streaming through gold leaves on the horse chestnut trees lining 16th Avenue, the purrs and putts of passing cars, immersed in the mathematics of the soul, wondering how a war could rage while a radio played a Chopin Polonaise. This was...
I love the end of it. Is it that short? Can it be that short?
Now, wait.
That's. I'm going to follow up quickly here, and then, David, get a poem. But you know, that's the thing. What is a lyric poem? It seems to me that modern poetry has begun to do these long essay-like poems, which just go on and on with information, and I'm not picking on For the Union Dead. I'm just talking, we were discussing earlier about the American Poetry Review, and I call these kind of mental spaghetti, these poems that are just packed with information, and I think there's something about, emotion, lyric. Did I lose my place here? I've got Hazel Hall in front of me. I love her work. She died in 1924. She was called a Georgian poet, but her work competed, I believe, with Emily Dickinson and Sarah Teasdale and those women. She was a feminist. She was a crippled seamstress. She never went to college, but her sister Ruth, I think, really helped define her taste. And in fact, I've decided in 2 weeks to do, I'll have some other people, women's voices and others, read Hazel Hall. But Hazel Hall had this amazing ability. She even had a premonition that she was going to die. She's a Portland poet, but of the time she was published in The Nation and New Republic, so too much information. This reminds me of imagism. Ezra Pound, William Carlos Williams, that period of time in American poetry. White branches. I had forgotten the gesture of branches, suddenly white, and I'd forgotten the fragrance of blossoms filling a room at night, in remembering the curve of branches who beckoned me in vain, remembering dark rooms of coolness where fragrance was like pain. I have forgotten all else. There is nothing that signifies. There is only the brush of branch and white breath against my lips and eyes. Now, she rhymes, but God, where she lays the rhymes, you know, it's, you know, and that alliteration, brush of branch and white breath. Anyway, Hazel
Hall. Did I hear you say she rhymes, but?
Okay, now we can talk about, do you want to talk about
formalism? Should we mark that one off your list?
No. What do you guys think about rhyming poems? Anyway, go ahead. I like internal rhymes, rhymes inside the poem. Okay, but talk. Yeah, you guys talk.
I don't think it matters whether a poem rhymes or doesn't rhyme.
No, I agree. Don't
you think if the rhymes are too regular that a lot of people think it's Edgar Guest or something?
I think if the thinking's too regular, it reminds you of Edgar Guest.
Yeah, okay.
You know, one of the things that really slays me is that, I mean, how many years has it been since free verse nudged out formal verse? I mean, what, 50 years more? And free verse poets today still refer to rhyming verse as old-fashioned.
Can't you do free verse and rhyme within the poem, you know? It's that rhyme on the end.
There are all sorts of things that are done in both, you know, metered and unmetered, rhyming and unrhymed poems that, I mean, all the poetic devices, the sounds, we have all that in common. I write a lot of rhyming poetry, but the last thing I would like anyone to say is, oh, well, those are nice rhymes. I could follow them right down. when you talk about internalizing rhyme, you can have internal rhyme, but the end rhyme should be internalized as well. It should become so much a part that it doesn't call itself out.
Right.
But I wonder right now if is there any, to your knowledge, any movement that you could put a label on? I know that new formalism was touted, 15 years ago.
Do we like labels?
Well, no, I know.
Is Sappho a movement? Was John Keats a movement? I guess at the time he got into trouble because he was a Cockney poet, but he was part of the, of course, we consider him part of the Romantic poets now, Byron, Shelley, and Keats. I love Keats myself, but anyway, you know, I wonder about all these labeling, though. Is this not some kind of academic sort of intellectual faddism that we get involved with that certain schools?
Well, when you bring up
schools of poetry, talk about schools of poetry.
Well, you brought them up. You mentioned imagism and modernism and so forth, so we're just following your lead. I think that the issue with people who object to rhyming poems or strictly non-rhyming poems is unfortunate, because I run into this all the time with students who will say, well, I don't like poems that rhyme, or I only like poems that rhyme in places I don't expect them, or I like it when a poem rhymes because I didn't know, especially when I don't notice the rhymes, which seems to me a poor reason to read. But I think that the issue is, taste notwithstanding, for someone to be in the art, to write, to want to read the art, to reject huge portions of the art, it would be like me saying, I don't want to look at a painting that has the color red. I only want to look at paintings that don't have the color red. Or I only want to look at paintings that the major color is the color red. Or I only want to listen to music that has a piano in it. If it doesn't have a piano in it, I can't listen to that music. It reduces the art to only what you like, not what the art has.
Well, we get involved in soundbite debates. I think the three people in this room, Walt Curtis, David Hedges, David Beispiel, we have, you know, we've been dealing with poetry for 30 or 40 years, and
I've only been alive that long.
Well, okay, that's your problem. I started writing in high school when I, you know, that was 1958. Just little goofy things. David, get one of your poems, David Beispiel, would you? And David, you get another poem, and which you guys figure out what to do, because I want to keep reading here. But, you know, I want poems here, but a crazy book, The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And Julian Jans, I can't sell this book to Paul's. No one wants to read it, but, you know, it's fascinating. It's kind of like early left brain, right brain kinds of thoughts about poetry. But what he claimed in a nutshell, and we're not going to lay this on very heavily here, but he claimed 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, he went to Princeton. This guy's not a dumbbell. The right side of the brain was the voice of the gods, and the message was delivered directly until human beings became conscious, you know, like the oracles in Greece, you know, the thing that comes in your head. So poets and schizophrenics are rhymers. And he says here just a few of these things. He claims that poetry originally was a sacred endeavor. The first poets were gods. Poetry began with a bicameral mind, the god side of our ancient mentality, at least in a certain period of history. I'm going to jump over here. He goes here, first of all, early poetry was song. The difference between song and speech is a matter of discontinuities of pitch. In ordinary speech, we're constantly changing pitch, even in the pronunciation of a single syllable. Modern poetry is a hybrid. It has the metrical feet of song with the pitch glissandos of speech. But ancient poetry is much closer to song. His case is that poetry used to be sacred, and it was divine. But poetry was a divine madness. All Plato said it was the my Greek is lousy. Katakoche are possession by the muses. All good poets, epic as well as lyric, compose their beautiful poems not by art, but because they are inspired and possessed. There is no invention in him until he has been inspired and is out of his senses, and the mind is no longer in him. You know, I really believe that. It's how I started writing poetry, off the top of my skull. And but respond if you like. Go ahead.
He must have never met a poet, because poets are anything but gods.
Yeah, really.
No. That's a theory of psychology and history we don't have to agree with. But I think we do know. You guys are not that, let's say, uneducated, not to know about right brain and left brain, you know, information. I mean, this is fact right now. This
David,
is fact.
Can I jump in?
Poetry was a sacred act. Jump in, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I was really intrigued with your column on Wendy Cope and light verse, because it's something, it's almost like being in the closet. You know, you say you write light verse. I mean, that
you don't even take yourself seriously.
That's right.
It's
right.
Like light sex.
But
I want to
throw out a limerick.
Go ahead, dude.
It seems like it's necessary after all of that right brain, left brain stuff. This is the bottom line. He eyeballed the minivan sticker. His wife and the salesman grew thicker. He said, "Sure, be nice if you whittle the price, but I won't try to force you to dicker."
David, you just lost a lot of intellectual points in this conversation. But,
I hope so.
But who gives
it
a crap?
Was getting a little too thick there.
I do feel that's why great poetry is great, because, it's historical.
Yeah.
It's hysterical. It's a direction to the muse. It's mystical. Okay.
I think you're right. I think all of that is absolutely right. But I don't think it matters what form it comes in.
Well, okay. Limericks. Okay. They're an Irish form. Limericks have been going on for 1,000 years. Yeah. It's nothing to be sneezed at. David, read Catharsis for me from your book, Pilgrims and Beggars. It's right here.
Oh, all right. Catharsis.
I love the last couple of lines, and you have a rich vocabulary. You almost go out of your way. I'm so tired of going to poetry readings and slams where you only hear the same words over, and no one will toss a word in. You're brave and beautiful by throwing in unusual vocabulary. I love it.
Okay, catharsis,
which is the gods, remember, isn't it? Isn't that a Greek word for? Yeah.
Right here, I'll stop among the nubby bunch flowers and the rats that look on without flinching, scrappy in their whiskery sheaths. And I'll go nowhere anymore and build nothing. I'll take this bog, it's gettable. Forget chastisement, no martyrs need apply for the trademark. That poet, with his voice, it's the only one he gets. I'm golden, open as a summer, alone with the peacocks. Spare us further practice. We'll hang on to our negatious pearls, some for the Duma of Alms, others to shun our gushing days. They come gradual now. These hours are well like a 12-inch ruler across a skeptic's knuckle. I can't modulate that gibber. No one skedaddles. Skewed, dusted up. Work tighter than a fever. Some nights I'm the dirty thrush whistling all the way to Ulster. Those striations of song are spittles of an unskilled heart. What I'd give to undo that luck.
You're a great poet. When you know, the richness of the language and your rhythms. Oh, well, we want you to choose another one. I want you to choose. David and I have read for years. Come on.
Well, you know,
we're just talking about his poetry. I'm going to find another.
We're going to run out of time. I want to hear about Poetry Northwest, and I'm sure
ask him the question.
People listening want to know about it too.
No,
well, yeah. I mean,
where's it from?
Poetry Northwest was the longest running poetry only magazine in the history of the United States. It was published began in the 1950s. It was founded by Carolyn Kaiser and Richard Hugo, and was edited for 36 years by David Wagner.
David Wagner, a long time, yeah, a good poet at one time, yeah. Seattle, Washington.
And I have been named the new editor for the magazine and moved the editorial offices here to Portland at the Attic.
Huh.
And it was out of circulation for the last 3 years. And it's new first issue of the new series will be in March.
Wow. What direction are you taking it? Is it going to
be Northwesty?
Well, I don't think we're not going to have it be poetry only, for one thing. I think the magazine has a noble reputation. It published many American poets, major American poets, alongside of up-and-coming, unknown, and first-time published poets. It published Szeszła Miłosz. It published Joyce Carol Oates when she wrote poetry. It published Harold Pinter when he wrote poetry. Published poets as different as Jory Graham and Wendell Berry. So I think that legacy is one I want to continue to do, uphold. So that's where I'm going to take it.
Yeah. That's exciting.
It is exciting.
Do you have a website or number or something?
There is a temporary website. It's poetrynw.org. There's a terrific staff. Just a great staff has come together to edit the magazine.
Well, congratulations.
They're just going to do a great job.
You know, it got tired after with the same editor, and I think that's what happened with Poetry Magazine, and David Hedges has been recently published in Poetry Magazine, and maybe you have too.
Yeah, he
has. Beispiel. But I think with the same editors over, Haydn Carruth was somewhere for, I don't know, 40 years, and on and on.
I don't think that's why Poetry Northwest died, though. There was some internal friction at the college
and funding problems.
Yeah.
Well, that was...
But I think Walt's right. The magazine, like any magazine that runs for decades, has good years and bad years. David's taste had solidified. And much the way I think that in Poetry Magazine, you bring it up, when Joe Parisi was the editor, his taste had solidified. And a magazine like that, like Poetry Northwest, like Poetry, APR, eventually, they need some new blood.
Theodore Retke was the mentor to David Wagner. And Theodore Retke, we can name some of his books if I can do one off the top of my head, can I? I don't know.
Open House, The Far Field.
Yeah.
What's the great line? In a dark time, the eye begins to see. But this is interesting because will it be competing with the Northwest Review at the University of Oregon? That's solidified too, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't know.
It's not a matter of competition.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be much of a competition.
But they do essays too, and they do biographical stuff. Well, congratulations. So Poetry Northwest, and do that again. Poetry NW.
The temporary site is poetrynw.org. People can go there. They can subscribe. We'd like to get as many people to subscribe before the first issue comes out, especially people who were fans of the magazine before. The response across the country has been just overwhelming. with the announcement that the magazine will be published again. So people are very excited.
Congratulations. Now, well, I've got you for a second. And Hedges and I have been on this show quite a few times. Now, I'm not shutting one out here, but what is the Attic Workshop? Would you want to...
The Attic is a studio. We offer classes, creative writing classes, four sessions a year, just like a college campus. Terrific people teach there. We have courses in poetry, in fiction, memoir, novel writing, screenwriting. We've had play writing. We have a class called Time to Write, where people who haven't been writing for a while but want to get going again, or they want to try it out, they can come, and it's like a drawing class. They can write while they're in the studio with some direction. We have about 200 students a year.
Congratulations. Wow. This really is a literary town, literate town, isn't it? Portland's a book town, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, who funds a thing like the Attic Workshop? You don't have to tell me exactly, but I mean, we've got the...
It's a private school. It's funded by students signing up for classes.
Okay. It's strange, though. Now we've got Poetry Northwest coming here. We've got the Attic Workshop. We've got Portland Arts and Lectures. We've got Oregon Literary Arts. We've got also, what's their name? The Mount Hood Writers, you know, they teach classes. Amazing city, isn't it, Portland?
Yeah, yeah.
They always said it was the rain. They always said we had the best library on the West Coast. Stuart Holbrook, the historian, used to say that about Portland. And Well, congratulations. Do you want more students, or is there a way of reaching the Attic Workshop?
People can reach the Attic online at atticwritersworkshop.com, or they can call. The number is 963-8783. We have the session for the fall has already started, but winter workshops have just been announced. They begin in January, and we have a few new classes and just terrific instructors. I bet the return students at the Attic is probably easily over 40%.
It's funny, you know, I haven't seen enough information about it, and I do have a problem. I want the Sunday Oregonian to be richer in what it covers, because the Attic Workshop is a topic there. The Poetry Northwest moving here to Portland is a topic, et cetera, et cetera. You have a new poem, don't you? Now, maybe, would you get it ready to read, David Bicepiel? But we'll go to David Hedges here. I know he wants to make some points. So are we covering a lot of these points? What's gone wrong? What's gone right with American poetry?
Well, we really haven't.
No, that's okay. We're not going to. You know, it's a poetry program.
Go ahead, Dave. No, let him go.
No, I'm some of the things we chatted about a little bit before. What is your thought on free verse as being old-fashioned in the 21st century, and is rhyme traditional verse the shock of the new century?
I think any period has a style that grows old, and it can grow old very quickly. In fact, it often grows old before anyone notices it. Imagism was brought up. I think it grew old very quickly. Deep Image, which came out, which was popular in the 60s, grew old very quickly. I think the standard sort of free verse today is written by poets who care more about the sentence than they do the line, whether they write in a regular meter or not. Mm. And it's created a kind of poetry, I think Walt put his finger on it, that's essayistic to some point, but it's not even that good. It's not that interesting.
Well, David, you bring...
And I have some examples.
David brings up the term formalism. Do you guys want to bat that around for a minute? I mean, what does that mean, David? Come on.
Well, to me...
What does it mean? What does formalism mean?
I'm trying to still figure that out, but I know that Mark Jarman I think he may have coined the phrase new formalism, and he and Robert McDowell were promoting that for
and
quite a few
Robert
years.
And who is Robert McDowell? He's part of Storyline Press.
In
Oregon.
It's my sense of it that never clicked in people's imaginations. And so, they're peddling it now under expansive poetry. And...
I'm going to lightly curse. God damn, what is all this label?
I don't know. I mean, I write a lot of traditional metered rhymed verse, and I don't know what a new formalist is.
Those writers that you mentioned and those movements, they came about as a response to, they just thought of kind of soft writing. And they wanted to electrify themselves. They came up also with an economics to support it, which all so-called movements will do. They'll get publishing magazines to put out issues that sponsor the new movement, and they'll get publishing houses like Storyline to publish work of those kinds of writers, and they'll get their comrades to review that work, and suddenly you have a movement. So they put an economics behind it as well. I think that, for me, the debate about formalism is a faux debate.
Mm-hmm.
There's no poetry without form, whether that form is
right.
rhyme or unrhyme.
A poem has to be shaped.
Absolutely.
There's no right. art without form.
No,
so
there is no
formalism
art.
Versus what? That's formalism versus silence. There's nothing there.
I hate to hear somebody's poem that is sloppy, careless, and does not even have an organic form. I it's the phrases. People develop their voice. You know, I have some. I hate to see an unshaped poem and then call it a poem, because I think when you use the word poetry, you should be talking about a refined, significant, something with passion and music and it's got to reach deep. I mean, poetry is significant. It has to be significant.
I think it's got to go even also beyond just the intent to reach deep.
Yeah.
The language has to be electrifying.
Yeah.
Have we passed through and beyond the phase where it was all about me and all about the little things in my life that
I am slicing a lemon poem.
Yeah, right.
I hope so, but anyway.
No, I don't think you ever will. Even a poem that's written in, you know, that's a dramatic monologue in someone else's voice is still a self-projection from the poet. So I don't think you can ever, you can't
Remember,
meet the definition. You can't meet the definition that Walt's talking about.
The bicameral mind. It's from
you can't,
the
yeah.
God
you,
speaking.
You
okay.
can't
yeah.
meet the definition that Walt is talking about and not write about yourself.
Yeah.
We have 10 minutes exactly to electrify. David,
wow.
Electrify. David Beispiel, I want you to hear your voice. Okay, you're going to get ready, and then I'm going to electrify. And okay, David Hedges, electrify us with some of our poetry, all the things we've learned in the last 40 years.
What have we learned in the past 40 minutes here?
David.
No, I.
He's going to get us a job at the Attic Workshop if we treat him nice. Just
oh, I see. Day. Well, okay.
Get okay.
Yeah. One of the things we skimmed right over was, we did talk about Poetry Magazine a little bit, but you have been published in American Poetry Review, and
we hate it.
I quit subscribing to it because. You know, there was no value for me. I would like maybe 4, 5, as many as 6 poems, and to find them, to wade through that gray matrix, to find the gems was an effort. Since it has been about 3 years since I subscribed, are they moving, or do you think they've solidified?
Well, I think for American Poetry Review, at least my knowledge and experience of it is there's 3 editors. There have been 3 editors for a few decades. And these 3, Arthur Vogelsang, Stephen Berg, and David Bonanno, they don't agree. They don't agree between themselves on what to publish. So you'll get the poems that one editor picks and poems that the other editor picks, and they just it's a mishmash. And so it's really hard to figure out what their editorial intention is at all. And their taste has, I would question it too. I enjoy reading that magazine.
We have 7 minutes and 30 seconds. David, are you going to read a poem or are you just going to talk?
Oh, yeah, I'd like
to.
If
you want to read a poem,
I
you don't
read,
do it. There's
yeah,
no time. The clock is ticking. Life is over. This is it. You're going to drop dead. You're going to be shot down by a gangster out here on the street.
I also got to say that every magazine is going to find its own way. And so if American Poetry Review is going to publish what is thought of as a sort of more experimental sort of writing, which is what they favor at the moment, that's fine. There's plenty of room for that kind of writing and that kind of publishing. And the fact that American Poetry Review has probably one of the largest circulations makes it a target.
Yeah, yeah. This poem really surprised me when it was accepted by Poetry because it is a Terza Rima. And it was an afterthought. I threw it in because I happened to like it, but I was surprised. And I think it was. Is this Chris Wyman's first issue?
No, that would have been about
the new Poetry Northwest. We can send poems to the new Poetry Magazine. David, we're down to 3 minutes. We know we have.
Oh, okay,
you read. He reads. I read, and we're done.
All right. Okay. On stirring the pot. The radiance, a brace of rich imaginations running wild through daisy fields without a stitch. And what of you, quixotic child? Are you a second Joan of Arc or Dorothy, the meek and mild? When running naked, only Stark will do. Divestiture requires as much of tinder as of spark. It's not the weak who fan the fires. The souls pressed hard against the mold know nothing of their own desires. They wind up winding down as cold as old refrigerator coils, their aspirations pigeonholed. Until the stuff you're stirring boils, nobody knows how hot you've turned, how plagued with disarray your toils. Look all about as books are burned. See how the faces radiate the sum of what mankind has learned. We're put on earth to procreate. One scratch won't satisfy an itch. God may be good, but greed is great.
Beautiful, beautiful. Very good, very good. David.
So this poem is called Port, not the drink, the place of departure, arrival.
Okay.
It's actually a brand new poem. I rolled out of there with my orders, doped up with the polar weight, a salty Judaist, stayed as a jut, doused with my holy spoof and sore with methodology, like a cowbell stuffed with a sock. And though I never knew what muck was in those miles, the paydays were juke houses and pearly cities, big-hearted as an afterlife, reiterated, sloping, turning off. Like farewells to spring, my face was satiny and lilac red. You'd think that under those loutish cares and all the boasts of wars, I'd find a new name to be called. But no whiffs to be found there, just a fanning drone, rooted in fabulous dark, moss-backed, unpardoned, like a star.
I really like your voice. I want to bring you back. You know, we got to read more poetry. You know, this is fine. It's been a great program. David Hedges, David Beispiel. I want to bring you back. I'm interested in your voice. This is Squash, and yokels pronounce it with an R. I'll squash you if you don't get out of my way. There is that heaviness to them rustling their dry and crackly leaves. Root vegetables, earth vegetables, buried in the ground or spread out swelling on the earth. Potatoes like brown clenched fists. Humans dig them up, shake off the dirt, shaking hands with resurrected cadavers. Pumpkin, squash, cucumbers, sweet onions, I love the plump vegetables. They fatten our flesh. A huge green Hubbard squash lying in the field is the size of a pregnant woman, swollen in late summer or early autumn. Cut it open with a butcher knife and see the white seeds of eternity lining the maternal stomach. The harvest moon is the color of the guts of squash, scooped out. Two dark green acorn boats are awash in butter, rather like little bathtubs from which I spoon rich, succulent, orangish mush. Squash makes me feel smug, satisfied, like a fat man with leaves growing out of his ass. Like in a squash, there's that kind of fullness, pushing out to the limits of the golden horizon. Our horizon is almost there. David, you're going to be at a reading for the New Orleans people at, is it ACME on next Sunday? Is that it, on the 13th? Your name came
it's,
on.
It's this upcoming Sunday. I don't remember where it is. It's down on the east side, Grocer's Row, kind of, I think.
We'll take up the gauntlet again on this subject and debate. Look for the new Poetry Northwest. David Hedges, are you doing anything upcoming here?
Young well, man. We have the Oregon State Poetry Conference. It's this Saturday in Eugene, and we have Maxine Skates, and I really wanted to.
It's too late.
I know it
take
is.
Five. I'm going to turn on take five. Listen, I thank both of you for being here.
Thank you.
It's time to run with the. We've got 10 people lined up here. The Talking Earth, David Beispiel, David Hedges. Thank you. We tried. God knows we tried. We'll try again. What's wrong or right with American poetry? I mean, we'll try. We're going to do it next time. We'll do it right next time.